Every year, the governor of South Dakota delivers a State of the State address to a joint session of the state legislature on the opening day of the session. The address typically offers a mix of accomplishments from the previous year and plans for the year ahead. Governor Noem's initiatives this year include an abortion ban, expansion of broadband services, ag industry investment, civics education, and scholarships. As we take a look at this first week of the 2021 South Dakota legislative session, we begin with an excerpt of Governor Kristi Noem's State of the State in her own words.
I look forward to the day when the Supreme Court recognizes that all preborn children inherently possess the right to life too. Until that time comes, I am asking that South Dakota and its legislature that will pass a law that bans the abortion of a preborn child just because that child is diagnosed with Down syndrome. With the help of several pro-life groups across the state, my team will present legislation for your consideration and for swift passage. As I outlined in my budget address, I believe that we can create an environment where families are not forced to choose between the modern economy on the one hand and then life in their hometown on the other. And that's why I'm proposing that we invest in finishing connecting this state with broadband. Even the most remote communities across our state should be provided the tools that they need to be connected. Thriving communities from border to border will yield much better results for our state and our families, rather than concentrated growth in just two big cities. So there are still 135,000 South Dakotans without high-speed broadband access that we need to meet those needs in the 21st century. A state investment coupled with industry funding and federal grants is enough to get the job done. Now, success would mean that our rural communities would have the opportunity to grow and that families would have the chance to stay home together. My hope is that we can work together to get our state connected, so we can set up this generation and the next for success, no matter where they want to live. To date, I am pleased to report that we had 23 new ag projects, resulting in more than 320 new jobs across the state of South Dakota. But even with all this good news, we need to continue to bolster our largest industry. And that's why the ag investments I proposed in my budget address are so crucial. The meat processing grants, the investment in the Dakota Events Complex, the creation of a program to give farmers more opportunity to market South Dakota meat products, and the merger of the Departments of Agriculture and Diener 2. Each of these items will help reinvigorate our number one industry and all of the families that it serves for so many years to come. And as we look towards the year ahead, I'm also excited to report to you that there's a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to our fight with COVID-19. Now, South Dakota is leading the nation in dispersing the COVID vaccine. In just over a month, tens of thousands of people across the state have received their first dose. Now, this is a testament to the incredible work that the team of the Department of Health and all of our medical professionals are doing. We should not be surprised. Our medical professionals stepped up in all kinds of unforeseen ways in 2020, and their stories deserve to be told. Another tool that we greatly expanded access to is telehealth. So since March, people have used tech services like these more than 70,000 times in South Dakota's Medicaid program alone. This year, I'm going to ask you to support legislation to make these flexibilities permanent. In 2021, we should build on telehealth advancements and continue to find ways to remove government red tape in healthcare. And as we look to improve the overall health and well-being of every South Dakotan, recreation is a key part of that conversation. This year, I'm asking the legislature to adopt simpler licensure requirements for kids under the age of 18. The goal is to get more people engaged at an early age so they continue those experiences long into their adulthood. This is one of the reasons why I have so heavily emphasized the importance of the Bounty program. Over the last 2 years, nearly 4,300 people participated in the Nest Predator Bounty Program, many being youth and first-time trappers. They have removed roughly 81,000 nest predators. That's a great thing for our pheasant numbers. Long-time hunters say that they have never seen as many roosters as they did this year. So that's good news for our state, for our future, and to continue to get folks to come here, visit us, and help us kill our state bird. Now, hunters are not the only people who come to our state this year. As I mentioned, this was a challenging year for tourism, but South Dakota has outperformed almost every single other state in the country in this category. In 2021, we are going to build on this momentum. We're going to ensure that we continue to grow. Our tourism department will be working on a new strategic plan to guide its overall efforts for the next several years to take advantage of the huge amount of interest that we have received. This includes enhancing our promotion of the state in new markets, and especially targeting key demographics that have an interest in our parks, our history, our culture, and our great outdoors. Given that three of our state's rodeos were recently chosen as the very best in the country by the National Finals Rodeo and the PRCA, we will also be improving our facilities for hosting equestrian and rodeo events. We know that our state has the potential to be the best place in the country for some of these events, and we want to capitalize on those opportunities in the years ahead. One of the main reasons our tourism numbers have been so strong this year is the resilience of our people and our small businesses. The South Dakotans who run these small businesses inspire all of us. And our businesses will have a better chance of success if South Dakota students have excellent educational opportunities. Everyone in this room knows that a good education starts in the home. It starts with strong families. We have decades of right research that shows us that families are the most critical influence on a child's success in the classroom. COVID-19 underscored just how involved parents need to be in their children's day-to-day education. It's our duty to find innovative solutions that empower parents to set up their children for success. This includes improving civic education for our kids. I have tasked my administration with creating instructional materials and classroom resources on America's founding, our nation's history, and the state's history. We must also do a better job educating teachers on these three subjects. Through all of this, our common mission and key objective needs to be explaining why the United States of America is the most special nation in the history of the world. Last week, we made an exciting announcement regarding the future of the Build Dakota Scholarship. Together, over the next 5 years, we will invest approximately $40 million to train students for high-demand career opportunities. We also announced the creation of the Premier Scholarship, a needs-based scholarship endowment for our state. Denny and the Premier Center have already delivered a check for $50 million and have pledged another $50 million going forward. I'm asking for your support in this, and they will match it with another $50 million in the future. This was one-time money that will be transformational in a gift to needs-based students to help them with their educations. The Premier Scholarship requires that students live and work in South Dakota for 3 years after graduation. Otherwise, the scholarship turns into a loan. The endowment for this critical scholarship fund needs $200 million to be self-sustaining into the future. Denny and Premier are getting us halfway there. Your action will get the fund to $150 million, and together we can get this done. The family is the cradle of civil society. Strong families create strong communities, and strong communities will produce the strongest state in the nation. This session, I hope you all will join me in standing up for families. Last year, we found so many ways to work together to maintain the freedoms of our people, to promote our outdoor heritage, to rein in the endless expansion of government into our daily lives. This year, it is my hope that we will find even more opportunities to work together, advancing common sense solutions to the problems that we can solve on behalf of the people of this great state. So I look forward to working with each of you and with all of South Dakota's leaders to improve our state for today and for the next generation. Thank you, and may God bless the great state of South Dakota.
Governor Noem talked about the importance of parents, education, and the need for greater civics education in South Dakota in that State of the State address. She was swiftly criticized by local educators for what many saw as divisive language in both her address and in her January 7th editorial in The Federalist, where she wrote, quote, "The left's indoctrination takes place every day with kids all across America from the time they walk into a school at age 5 to the time they graduate at 22, end quote. Now, how does a governor's initiative translate to legislation? To help us get a better understanding of the reality beyond the rhetoric, we invited Tiffany Sanderson to the program. She's the state's new Secretary of Education.
Secretary Sanderson, thank you for sitting down with us today. We appreciate your time.
You bet. It's great to see you.
We are looking at the start of a new legislative session. Governor Kristi Noem has given her State of the State address and laid out some of her priorities. Lawmakers have gathered in Pierre. And I'm wondering, as Education Secretary, what are some of your legislative priorities for the 2021 session?
I think there's probably three different buckets that are most important as we're looking over the next 36 days now. One, civics education that the governor mentioned in her State of the State yesterday. Two, as we look ahead in schools from COVID and all that we've learned over the last 10 months, making sure that we have priorities in place to help support our students in our schools and address some of the things that we've learned. And then there'll be topics that come to us from a variety of different places that we'll be engaged in. A couple of those that we're aware of right now are around the initiated Measure 26 that the voters passed in November relating to medical marijuana, and other proposals related to schools. There's a bill out that brings back the discussion from last year on community-based schools and other proposals that we'll be part of.
Let's start with civics education. Governor Noem had an editorial in the Federalist last week, and then this week in her State of the State, she talked about how important good education was, including civic education of our kids. They should see firsthand the importance of civic engagement. They should have robust discussions in the classroom so they can develop critical thinking skills, and they need more experience engaging with elected officials and practicing the art of debate. It's also our responsibility to show them how government works. Those were sort of her big picture thoughts. So what does that look like in a form of legislation compared to what we already have in civics education in the state and where you think that we need to go?
Yeah, so I think this is a conversation about, one, continuing all of the good things that we have in motion in South Dakota, and then looking at what are the additional supports that can provide to teachers and to students so that our students are prepared as they leave high school to be engaged and productive citizens throughout our communities in the state. So there have been some questions that have arisen around what does this mean in terms of what we'll be adding to the curriculum or what we'll be displacing from what students are learning. So I think there's a couple of angles that we should look at as we're talking about how do we best prepare students for their futures as citizens here in the state and the roles that they'll play as private citizens or as leaders in their community if they're serving on school boards or county commissions or anything like that. So we want to make sure that they have a strong foundation in understanding what our history looks like, how we got to this point, what makes it special, and how they can engage in civil discussion and have those critical thinking skills that allow them to participate wholly and in a civil way. So in terms of your question on legislation, what does that look like? So we've got a couple of opportunities as we look forward. You're probably familiar that the governor proposed $900,000 in funding. That funding will help to accelerate efforts around instructional materials for the classroom, and I'll talk about that in just a bit in more detail, teacher training, and then making sure that schools have the resources that they need to engage students in real life experience, real world experience, seeing their government in action or participating in things like you mentioned, Lori, debate, mock legislatures, service learning that give them firsthand experience while they're young and in a coachable environment with trusted teachers.
Give me an idea of how this works now. You and I are both parents. My daughter's on to college now, but as an engaged parent, of course, at the time she went to the Sioux Falls School District and Washington High School is where she graduated, I could go on that website and look up just a lot of things about the curriculum and what they were learning without even talking to my child about it. So I have a familiarity with the depth of that in the Sioux Falls School District. Are there problems with other school districts? Is there something, I guess what I'm wondering is if there is a demonstrated lack, or if there is a perceived, you know, these students are coming to college and they somehow didn't gain this information, or do we have like a gap in curriculum across the state for civics education?
So some of the things that South Dakota is doing very well that other states haven't paid as close of attention to over time. So I give this credit to educators. I give this credit to school board members and policymakers. Our students graduate from high school, like you mentioned, Lori, with American government in their background, with US history in their background, plus an additional 1.5 units in other social studies contents that might be econ or other similar areas. And they also have a speech or debate experience. Not all states require that. So that's one of the things that goes really well in South Dakota. Another strength that we have is that all of our schools have content standards in all areas, but as we're talking about social studies content here from elementary level up through the high school years, as a group of educators and experts in that area, people have agreed on what's most important for students to know and understand and be able to do related to social studies content. So those are real strengths of what we've got in place already. A couple of things that we need to consider, though, as our teachers are preparing for careers going through university programs, not all of them have a background in U.S. history, American government, or South Dakota history. And so we can have conversations about, is that something that we jointly think is an important experience for our pre-service teachers to have if they're going to be an elementary teacher or a middle school or high school social studies teacher? In a similar vein, we don't have any cohesive, easily accessible instructional materials or resources to teach South Dakota history or South Dakota government, economics, geography. And that $900,000 will help to develop those kinds of instructional materials. So teachers have lesson plans to be able to provide that instruction in the classroom, and students have access to things like primary documents, historical photos and videos, or interviews with South Dakota experts that really bring the rich story of our state to life.
Let's talk a little bit about the push for civics education in previous years, 2019, and Secretary Ben Jones was on the show talking about that at this time. Lots of debate. Those bills did not pass. What do you think you learned from that experience as you look back on it and say, this is what we need to fine-tune the legislation to create something lawmakers can get behind?
Sure. So I think the major debate in 2019 was around requiring students to pass the citizenship test, the United States citizenship test for graduation. And the crux of that came down to, is it right to add more assessment requirements to our students' experience? People agreed that our students, South Dakota students, should know what new citizens in the United States know about our country. And as we've looked at what's already in our content standards for social studies between second grade and 12th grade, our South Dakota students experience every one of those 100 questions on the citizenship test at least three times. So our students have that experience in the classroom, that knowledge. And so as we're looking at the 2021 conversation, rather than what are the assessment requirements, let's talk about what the experiences that our students and our teachers have, what are they equipped with so that they are prepared, our students are prepared as they enter adulthood to be engaged citizens.
Who looks at the curriculum and makes choices about content? Do lawmakers get to see that and make choices about what they like and what they don't like? Is that up to the Department of Education? Tell us how curriculum development works in the state.
Thanks for asking that. And so I'm going to answer in a pretty nerdy or wonky education way, if that's okay. And so we'll distinguish between content standards and curriculum. The Department of Education oversees content standards for all content areas. That's outlining what students should know, understand, and be able to do, whether that's in math or science or social studies or business education or fine arts. And so if you think about content standards, it's kind of like baking a very basic cake. There are certain elements that any cake is going to need. And so that's what our content standards also reflect. Curriculum is something that school districts use to bring to life in the classroom those content standards. So in this case, if students are required in fourth grade to understand geography of the state, where is Pierce, South Dakota, our state capital? Teachers, school districts are deciding what's the curriculum, how do I deliver that instruction in the classroom so that my students understand and know what their state capital is, where it's located on a map, and what might be unique about South Dakota's state capital. So there's a distinction there. The Department of Education, again, charged with the content standards. School districts are charged with curriculum.
When you talk about the $900,000 and giving the teachers the resources they need, though, is there a purchase of curriculum on the state level for distribution to schools that want it? Tell me more about that. I feel like there's one little piece of information that I'm not quite connecting, so help me out.
And I would say that the conversation that we're having around instructional materials for South Dakota history and government are unique in this content standards versus curriculum. There isn't a textbook creator in the country that's going to create instructional materials on South Dakota history and government. And so that's why we're talking about bringing together the experts in that area, educators, historians. We've got great partners in this state, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, with the instructional materials and resources that you all provide, museums throughout the state that have resources that can all come together and help students experience firsthand, understand our rich history.
All right, let's talk a little bit about number two bucket, which is COVID-19. We're still very much living with that, even as vaccine distribution in the state is going quite well compared to other states. This is still a pandemic and we still are behaving accordingly moving forward. What do we know about how the pandemic has infected this generation of kids in K through 12? Because it's easy to hear lots of doom and gloom stuff about this lost generation and how they'll never catch up. And as a parent, I question that. And I think, well, don't throw them out just yet because they had a difficult year. But what are you seeing from test scores, from hearing from school superintendents about how is it going? How dire is the situation? And how much has COVID-19 really impacted students long-term in South Dakota?
Yeah, great question. And I so appreciate that you recognize the resiliency of kids and their interest to be positive and hopeful. And I would say that's what we see in the classroom with kids right now is, yes, it is a very interesting time and education looks different and their experience has been different, but they are resilient and they're ready to learn, they're ready to engage, and their educators are there to support them. So I'd say we're kind of in phase three of pandemic response for schools. Phase one was last spring, as schools moved to a remote distance learning environment. Everybody turned on the fly and did their best to address student needs and finish out the school year. Phase two was coming back in person this fall and mitigating viral spread, making sure that students had the resources that we needed. You had asked about what are we seeing. I would say, yes, we saw things across the board. We had students who had done really well in remote learning and were on pace from last school year when they moved to remote learning. We saw students who had fallen behind in academics for a variety of reasons and needed some additional supports academically. And we saw the stress of the entire situation. It might be parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents losing jobs or having a different home environment over the spring and summer, impacting mental health and social emotional needs. We had students who, special populations through special education, English learners who needed some additional supports. And so schools have been working in multiple ways to offer a variety of options for instructional delivery to their families and to provide supports this last fall that helped address students where they were at and move them forward in their full well-being, both academic and mental health. And I think we're entering phase three now of COVID response as we get into this second semester. Schools have figured out mitigation strategies that are working very well, have kind of come into stride with the variety of instructional options that they're offering their families. And as you mentioned, we're very much in this pandemic, but we're also looking at the strides out of it as vaccines are becoming available. Our school nurses right now are part of the group who have access to the vaccines, and our teachers, administrators, and staff will be part of the next group that's projected to start vaccinations in February.
So when teachers get vaccinated, they will do so through their school?
Correct.
And through their school nurses. Okay.
They won't receive the vaccines typically through their school nurses, but the regional approach to vaccine distribution, the first group in schools to receive those vaccines will be the school nurses. That's currently happening. And then all other staff will be part of the group that is projected to start in February.
I want to talk just a minute about urgency, because I want to be careful not to minimize anybody's concern about how difficult this year has been for their students. And as parents, we watch our kids grow up, you know, so quickly, and all of a sudden, you know, hey, fourth grade is done, and that whole unit on South Dakota history, or that first year in orchestra, that's the year my student missed. Or you're in high school preparing for college graduation, and this ACT was a nightmare for us, and you don't get another chance at it. You're a mom as well, and without, you know, speak to that sort of that sense of urgency that can almost spill into panic if you're anybody like me, where every once in a while you think, how much should I be worried, and you let your head get a little bit far away. But it's important, and it can't, when you have a child going through the system, you only get so many chances to build certain developmental skills. Talk about that for a little bit in a year that has been so disruptive for so many people.
Right. You know, and I see it through the growth of my own son. He's now 13. When he started remote learning last spring, I could still look him eye to eye. And at this point, I have to look up to see his eyes. That really puts in perspective that this time is fleeting, and so much is happening developmentally in a short period of time for all of our kids, whether they're itty bitties in kindergarten to ready for adulthood at the senior level. I read a study about student and educator perspectives on priorities of this school year. It was done in August, and it was a group of in the classroom teachers who were polled, and then high school students who are interested in becoming educators themselves. And one of the questions was student activities, extracurricular activities, what kind of priority level do we give them in this time? And there was a huge divide between student perspectives and adult perspectives in that study. About 10% of adults viewed that as a high priority, and about 60% of our young people viewed that as a high priority. They crave that social engagement with their peers, the opportunity to connect, the ability to interface and discuss what's weighing on their minds or what they're experiencing, and to find some normalcy. So to your question, Lori, we have to, as adults, think through all the perspectives here. This is a blip in our lives, but this is a big moment in our kids' lives. And we need to make sure that even in a different time, a different approach, we're addressing their full well-being and needs as developing young people.
Yeah, it's been sobering as well. On to sort of a third area of discussion. You mentioned initiated measure 26 and medical marijuana. Make the connection to me between education and that legislation.
You bet. So many agencies, many legislators are looking at the passage of initiated measure 26 and what that means for implementation as we go forward. You might be familiar that there was a section in the initiated measure that spoke to implementation in schools, medical marijuana implementation in schools. And so we're having conversations about what that looks like and means as we go forward. And I think that will be an ongoing discussion throughout session.
All right. And again, school nurses come into that conversation pretty strongly. Tell me who some of the people around the table really need to be for that conversation.
You bet. So a wide variety. As I talk with superintendents and school board members, major interest is understanding the issue and how do we ensure the safety of our staff and students and the public who comes onto school grounds. So school nurses, bus drivers, teachers, the full support staff, teaching staff within a school. It really will impact everybody, and we're all working to learn more about those impacts and how we can best recognize what the voters put in place this year.
The focus may shift to politics and public policy during the legislative session, especially as lawmakers debate appropriations of the surge in budget dollars. The state is still in the grips of a pandemic. More than 100,000 South Dakotans have contracted the disease so far. More than 41,000 have been vaccinated. More than 1,600 have died of COVID-19. South Dakota Democrats say health care is one of their priority issues for the 2021 legislative session. Senate Minority Leader Troy Hienert says it's essential to allocate resources to fight the coronavirus and help those who have suffered. House Minority Leader Jamie Smith says bipartisan efforts are essential to pass any bills. Democrats lost 4 seats in last November's election. They now have 11 members between both the House and the Senate. Senator Hienert and Representative Smith joined us to discuss their priorities this legislative session and how they plan to actualize them. Senator Hienert, welcome. Thanks for returning to In the Moment today.
Well, hi, Lori. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate the time.
Representative Smith, thanks for being here as well.
Yep, glad to be with you. It's always a good way to start off our session.
All right. It's a big session with a lot of work. We were just hearing SDPB reporters lay out I think it's fair to say a massive amount of work and money to deal with, appropriations and ideas and coronavirus precautions and everything like that, going into a challenging session for sure, but also one ripe with opportunity. So, Senator Hienert, I'm going to start with you. Tell us a little bit about what some of your legislative priorities are going to be, and then we'll talk in a minute about just the rhetoric and the political climate that we have right now. But first, I want to stick with this idea of when you come into this session, what are some of your priorities?
Well, you know, this year is different than years past because of coronavirus. You know, I think one of our legislative priorities are to make sure that we have the resources to actively fight the coronavirus, make sure that resources are available to get the vaccine out. You know, we are looking at some possibilities of helping healthcare systems or really people that maybe ended up in the hospital and have enormous hospital bills because they were underinsured or have no insurance, yet contracted COVID and spent significant time in the hospital. So those are some of the legislative priorities that we need to be mindful of this year that in years past weren't on our radar. You know, our other priorities are healthcare in general, education, you know, opportunities for young people to gain scholarships to attend a university or a tech school. You know, a lot of the same things that we bring year after year that make a difference in South Dakotan people's lives.
Yeah. Representative Smith, I know a lot of people who have had healthcare emergencies during this time and haven't even seen the bills yet. My daughter was in the hospital early in the pandemic in New York City in March. And that's still coming for a lot of people, those big expenses. So Jamie Smith, tell us a little bit about it can feel like as we move forward with the vaccine that this crisis is over, and it is so far from over right now. Talk a little bit about that right now, please.
Well, Laura, you're exactly right that we still don't even know the full effect of this. It was very nice that the federal government actually extended our ability to spend some of that money and make some decisions on that. And there'll be other rounds of stimulus money coming in, I'm sure. But to Troy's point, this uninsured or underinsured people and these bills that are coming, you're exactly right. They don't come right away. They come later, and they can be devastating. So we're trying to keep an eye on that. And I know there was talk about, you know, helping health systems out for unrecoverable costs. Well, we'd like the money to go to the patient so the patient could pay their bill so the hospital doesn't have uncovered costs. And so it's just a direction that the money flows and keep the person whole, because, you know, once you damage your credit and all of those things that can happen, it has a devastating effect not only on your health, but then on your financial well-being in the future. And we want to make sure that doesn't happen. The other thing
do you have
is,
ways that you think I'm going to jump in real quick with a follow-up before you go on, Jamie, and that is do you have ways that you think that the money can go directly to or the people who might have some of those expenses? Are you talking Medicaid expansion? Are you talking grant program for hospital bills? What are some of your ideas?
Those are the things that we're exploring right now, and they're having conversations behind the scene on, you know, what can that look like? What types of things and vehicles can we set up to make that happen? But those are the discussions we're having. Those are the types of problem-solving, talks that we're having is what does this look like? What can it look like? And how could we proceed? And then it becomes trying to get other people to agree with us on making that happen. And so those are things that keep us up at night and talking late into the night.
Yeah. And you wanted to go on and say more priorities. Leader Smith, go ahead with that.
Well, I just wanted to say that our with all of the stuff that we have going on with the pandemic and the coronavirus and everything, we still have all the same essential business of the state that we need to look at. Our teachers, our healthcare workers, our community support providers, our nursing homes, our roads, our infrastructure, all of those things go on whether or not there's a pandemic or not. And we need to make sure that we keep giving our children a quality education in the state of South Dakota, that we're providing those opportunities for their future, that we don't have a lost generation here because of this pandemic. And that's a challenge. And we embrace that challenge and we'll work forward to try to make sure that all those things happen.
I want to talk a little bit about education, but also about rhetoric and the political climate that we live in right now. And I've been reminding people frequently that when President Trump was elected in 2016, we had conversations about definitions of fascism and authoritarianism because people were throwing words around pretty loosely. And here we are with President-elect Biden, and we're hearing words like communism and socialism thrown around pretty loosely as well. So we're going to have a conversation in our second hour about the definition of socialism and communism and sort of getting grounded in facts there. But I want to talk about Governor Noem's State of the State and some recent speeches she's given in an editorial published in The Federalist, where she talks about the newly elected senators from Georgia to the U.S. Senate. She calls them communists. And then she talks about education and the indoctrination, I'm quoting from her piece, takes place every day with kids all across America from the time they walk into school at age 5 to the time they graduate college at 22. She says they don't know about our decades-long fight to defeat communism, and she talks about the radical left here. And this is part of this national sort of rhetoric, and both of you issued a statement urging her to use different language and to bring her dialogue home to South Dakota instead of this this sort of Washington kind of staging that you believe she has. I'm going to give you a chance to talk more about why you think language and rhetoric, especially around things like education and such, are really impactful here at home during the legislative session as you try to do the people's work. Senator Heinert, would you like to begin addressing that?
Sure. We were very disappointed that 2 days after what we saw happen in our nation's capital and at the Capitol building, that she chose to continue that path of harmful rhetoric. And, that Wednesday changed the world. And it wasn't just that day that caused that. That was months, if not years, of radicalization by using words such as communism, socialism, calling on fellow Americans to distrust their government and an election. We challenged the governor on those statements. We thought it was appropriate because staying silent, we saw what staying silent has done. and chalking it up to politics as usual. And that can't go on anymore. And I think that's what you're going to see from our caucus going forward, is that when we hear statements like that, that aren't factually based, that seek to divide us even further, we are going to call people out on that. That is not how we talk. We shouldn't be talking about fighting. We should be talking about advocating for causes. And that is just a different vernacular and a different way and to get things done. And hopefully, our Republican colleagues will feel the same.
Representative Jamie Smith, have you had any indications? We watched the governor on Fox News this morning indicating about some abortion legislation she's beginning, or she's urging lawmakers to move forward. She talked about how she would speak today about strong families. Do you have any ideas of what the State of the State address might hold from your vantage point, what we might expect?
Yeah, Lori, we met with the governor last night. She went through her talking points, and there's always a few things that come up in the State of the State that we probably didn't get in our talking points historically, just through the years. We don't go over the entire speech, but one of the things that we did agree on, and we really are looking for an opportunity to work together on, is the $50 million that Sanford and First Premier put into that scholarship, and they're looking for a state match on. Needs-based scholarships have been an issue of ours for a very long time, and I think you're going to see a portion of the speech dedicated to that. The governor told us she's going to talk about the past, the present, and then how we move to the future. What we're asking is that we work together to move into that future, not to dwell necessarily on the past, and let's move into the future together. I'd like to go back to Troy's point on rhetoric and speech, and something that our caucus, has long pushed for is that as a Democrat in South Dakota, we can't do anything without working with our friends across the aisle to get something done for the state of South Dakota. And, I'd like to have a bigger caucus, and I'd like to have it be, less of a divide that way in numbers. But it forces us to be better. And it forces us to bring bills that are bills that the bipartisan world can, that we can, I'm sorry, Alexa's talking in my room here.
Sure.
What we can do is when we work together, we can get these things done, is what I wanted to say. And negative rhetoric doesn't help at all. Yeah. And you've known me a very long time, and respect is the number one thing that we have to have for each other. And that's what I want. I'd like you in the media to push positive discourse, we can disagree without being disagreeable, but we have to model that. And that's our job as leaders, is to model that. And that's what we're asking for, is leaders to model how to behave with political discourse.
Governor Noem also plans to merge the state's Department of Agriculture with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources via executive order. How do South Dakota agriculture producers feel about that transition? SDPB's Laura Rohde has more.
Agriculture is South Dakota's number one industry, and this legislative session, Governor Kristi Noem plans to issue an executive order to merge the Department of Agriculture with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. This makes South Dakota the third state in the nation without a designated Department of Agriculture. To understand what our state's farmers and ranchers think of this change, I reached out to leaders within the industry.
Myself and my family have a cattle ranch, and We also have a farm and ranch supply store at Union Center.
I'm a ag business owner, farmer rancher from Parade, South Dakota.
Yeah, I farm on a farm that my great-grandfather founded back in the early 1900s, and my sons are operating it today.
We have a family farm operation by Volga, South Dakota, where we feed cattle and raise corn and soybeans.
That's Senate Majority Leader Gary Kamak, House Representative Orrin Lesmeister, South Dakota Farmers Union President Doug Somke, and Farm Bureau President Scott Vanderwall. Based on their understanding of what this merger will look like, as well as feedback from their constituents and members, some of these leaders support the merger while others oppose it. What most do agree on is the fact that the governor's decision came as a surprise.
I was kind of taken back that we had not heard a single word about this merger coming forward from the governor's office or anything. There was no talk about it. There was no just reach out and see what people thought about it. Before we take our state's number one industry department and merge it with another without any of the ag groups having any input at all, asking anybody at all, it just seemed like it would have been a lot better hill to climb, or easier hill to climb, than having to explain yourself after the fact.
That's Representative Orrin Lesmeister. Many of those he serves in Corson, Dewey, and Zeebock counties are farmers and ranchers. He says 75% of those he hears from are against the merger. While Farm Bureau policy supports the merger because 70% of the organization's farmer rancher delegates voted in favor of it at the 2020 state convention in November, the organization's president, Scott Vanderwall, says because they had not heard anything about the merger until after it was announced, he and his members proceeded with caution.
Well, we were a little bit reserved at first. We hadn't heard it was coming. And so we reserved judgment for quite some time. We had some calls from folks that said, no, we're going to oppose this, right? And we said, no, we're gonna take our time and be deliberative about it and find out what all the aspects and details are about it, and maybe see if any other states have done it around us, and then make a decision on an informed basis going forward. And that's what we did.
Because three of the four producers interviewed were not aware of the governor's decision to merge the departments until the announcement, I asked Hunter Roberts, Secretary of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources and Interim Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, about why more stakeholders were not part of the decision process. Robert says it was all about timing.
Frankly, I'm not the one that made the decision. So I guess what my comment would be, the reason the decision was made is that there was some discussions for a month or so about that potentially happening. Then the governor's office, myself, the lieutenant governor, and the Bureau of Finance and Management looked at what the timeline was on budget proposals and decided that if we were going to do it this year, we needed to do it relatively quickly, or else we were just running out of time.
After the decision, Roberts, along with the Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden, did reach out to agriculture leaders and the organizations they serve. Scott Vanderwall says after Farm Bureau members learned that the merger would streamline processes and save taxpayers' dollars, they voted to support the merger.
I think we can also say to farmers and ranchers that are that deal with both the DNR and the Department of Ag on a regulatory basis that maybe we can make their lives a little bit easier by combining some of those trips and working with fewer people and fewer visits.
The visits Vanderwall references are inspections made annually to dairies and large concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Today, these large farms, many of which are still owned and operated by South Dakota families, are inspected annually by both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. The Department of Ag staff inspect livestock and facilities to ensure animal health and milk quality, while the Department of Environment and Natural Resources staff inspect farms' facility design and manure management plans to ensure they do not have a negative impact on our state's soil, air, or water. Although staff from both departments visit the same farms, it is for different purposes, and it's the value District 28A Representative Oren Lesmeister sees in these two unique purposes that is among the reasons he is opposed to the merger.
There is some redundancy there, but it is a checks and balances reason for it. In 1973, I think it was, they reorganized and had a Department of Ag and a Department of Natural Resources. One of the reasons was it was too much of a burdensome on one department to try to handle both things, both sides of the entity. I still think that today that would still be an issue, especially with limited staff. So there's a lot of red flags, a lot of concerns. I understand maybe trying to get rid of some redundancy, but at the end of the day, I still think we need to do what's right for state and not for just a budgetary cut.
In addition to maintaining strong checks and balances, Doug Somke, president of South Dakota Farmers Union, says Farmers Union members oppose the merger because they believe agriculture deserves a dedicated state department due to its economic impact.
Seriously? From an industry that provides $30 billion to the economic engine of the state, you're worried about saving $400,000?
Somke points to Alaska and Rhode Island as two other states that have merged departments of agriculture and environment and natural resources. And according to 2019 U.S. Department of Agriculture Economic Research Service data, their agriculture industries are much smaller. In 2019, cash receipts for all agriculture commodities in Alaska amounted to $38.3 million, while Rhode Island's cash receipts added up to $64.4 million. South Dakota's cash receipts were $8.9 billion. Cash receipts do not provide a complete picture of the economic impact agriculture has on the state's overall economy, says Eric Gerlach, the state statistician for the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Agriculture Statistics Service.
$8.95 billion. Now, that's just a raw number. When we think about economic impact, though, depending on how you measure it and which research tools you are using, those dollars expand as they track through the economy. So there could be multipliers of 1.2 or higher in how it has a total impact in terms of employment and other industries that rely on agriculture within the state.
According to the 2019 South Dakota Agriculture Economic Contribution Study published by South Dakota Department of Agriculture, agriculture generates $32.5 billion in annual economic activity and employs more than 132,000 South Dakotans. The impact agriculture has on South Dakota's farm and ranch families and rural communities is not lost on farmer and rancher leaders, Senate Majority Leader Gary Kamak.
Everything that I've seen doesn't call for any elimination of any of the programs or any of the folks that are serving in a field situation or dealing with the permitting and that sort of thing. So the amount of focus that's being put on agriculture or on the environment should remain the same.
Although a vote is not necessary to merge the two departments, the legislature can, through resolution, oppose the merger. If the legislature does not oppose the merger, the governor's executive order takes effect 90 days after it is issued. The new department would be called the Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Hunter Roberts, who together with his family owns and operates a farm and ranch southeast of Fort Pierre, would serve as its first secretary. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
Tune in Mondays to In the Moment on SDPB Radio for a reporter roundtable where we recap the work of the legislative session and preview the week ahead. On Wednesdays, we gather a panel of journalists, political scientists, and former lawmakers for our weekly Dakota Political Junkie segment. Daily on In the Moment, for each day of the legislative session, you'll hear government in action with our In Their Own Words segment. And to follow Statehouse coverage every day, subscribe to the SDPB News Podcast. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.